tap tap, a tap tap, whip up a tap, a tap tap. Gold Mary in the bag, tied around my Andy for my protection. I'm walking around, big old sack on my back, coming in your direction. What kind of tea do you like? I got it. I'm the medicine man, herb from the land, yeah. Oh, I'm the herb man, come see me. Oh, I'm the herb man, you all come see me. Hey, Rosemary, calm your nerves, got peppermint leaf to get rid of my fever. I keep periwinkle to get some love now. Whoa, I got hug me clothes to make my backbone strong. Gold cola tonic for my blood, dandelion for my bones, y'all. I can leave to keep away flies. Hot lady cayenne for my pressure. Oh, I'm the herb man, come see me. Oh, I'm the herb man, you all come see me. Get the children out of the way now. No, you can't smoke this, sir. This is for salad. Yes, for salad. Herb man, herb man.
And good afternoon, and welcome to another episode of To Your Health. To Your Health is a program designed not only to inform, but to also turn your life and health around. I am Dr. Theodore Watkins, the host of To Your Health, and I'm here with my able, trusty assistant, Brother Frank Smith. How you doing, Brother Frank?
I'm doing well, Doc. How about you?
I'm excited. You know, I love this weather, and I've been out there playing with my flowers, man. So I'm feeling good. You know, we've been talking about I Too Have a Dream for several weeks now, and today I thought we would talk about a subject that I find very important. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And you know that saying is rings true for you regardless of what age you are. In fact, I believe that as adults, we need to really learn it so that we can teach it to our children and our grandchildren. Mm-hmm. But, you know, sometimes we act like we don't really care whether we're healthy. That is, until we get sick.
Sure.
And once we get sick, then we start to be concerned. Let's think about it. A little effort now can actually go a long ways to prevent a lot of trouble and discomfort down the road. And so focusing on prevention, like staying active, eating well, monitoring your health, can really make a difference in avoiding bigger health issues. So today we're going to talk about this thing of prevention. And we're going to come from a perspective that, we can really make a difference in our lives. As I was preparing for this presentation, Brother Frank, I ran across some research that indicated that now the most deaths in the United States are preventable and are related to nutrition. Bill and Melinda Gates, through one of their foundations, funded a study, and it discovered that the number one cause of disability and death in this country is our diet. And for the first time, it actually bumped cigarette smoking out of the number one spot, And so we need to really give some attention. You know, the since the article recognize that death and disability is preventable and related to nutrition, then you would expect, obviously, that nutrition would be the number one thing taught in medical school. And that when you went to the doctor, the number one thing they would talk to you about would be nutrition, right? Mm-hmm. Wrong, Brother Frank, wrong. You know, so we need to find a way to connect this disconnect between the science and the practice, all right? To help us do that, I've asked one of my friends, you know, I mean, he's an esteemed scientist. He did his undergraduate work in chemistry at the Washington Adventist University. I met him just before he went to do his medical degree at the Doctor of Medicine at Penn State, you know, and then he went on to do his internship internal medicine internship, and then a fellowship in endocrinology and metabolism. He's a fellow at the American College of Endocrinology, associate director of the Journal of Diabetes and Metabolism and Journal of Research Administration. I can go on and on about the rest of the time talking about this brother. He's past chairman of endocrinology at Howard University. But like I said, the main thing, he is my friend. And I told him I wanted us to talk about this thing of preventative medicine. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. In reference to the eight laws of health. So first I want to welcome you, Dr. Cheatham.
Thank you.
You're not a stranger to this program, and I just appreciate you coming and sharing your wealth of information. So the eight laws of health is a mnemonic. It's new start. Nutrition, exercise, water, sunshine, temperance, air, rest, trust in divine power. Now, as a general principle, why is these eight laws of health so important to us from a medical preventative perspective?
Well, it turns out, Dr. Watkins, as you have already pointed out or alluded to, we are what we have eaten. If we think back to when we were children, or beyond that, if we look at children today who are being cared for by parents, being carried around by mothers, or actually even before they were born, mm-hmm. within the mother's abdomen, those human cells are being nourished, are being supplemented with, and being given nutrients and growth factors that come from what before birth the mother was eating, and after birth what the baby, and then child, and then young adult, and then adult are eating. But we also, as your point was made of the eight essentials of health, breathe air, we get sunlight, we drink water, we exercise, we do other activities that all help us metabolize what we have eaten. But so many people, I guess when they become young adults and on through the rest of their ages, begin to lose focus on the fact that if we hold our hands out, if we look in the mirror, if we ask others to look at us, what is visible and what is being seen has only been sustained and generated by what we have put into our bodies.
People, you know, as you was talking there about, you know, what the mothers eat and what they feed to their children. I remember early on when I first left surgery and started doing this holistic medicine thing, I read an article where they had looked at babies that had died in utero, died before they were born. And when they did autopsies on them, many of them had cholesterol streaks in their aortas. Before they were born, they were already developing atherosclerosis.
Yes.
And it was because of what their mothers had eaten.
That's
and
exactly
so right. These eight laws of health are really, really critical. You know, there's a group or several groups of people around the world that tend to follow health principles, and they've been studied and documented in a number of research studies. They call them the blue zones, places where people live longer than anyone else. And there are five of them, one in Japan, one in Italy, one in Costa Rica, one in Greece, and one here in the United States. And the one in the United States is out there in Loma Linda, California. And there are a group of Seventh-day Adventists that follow these eight laws of health, these eight laws of health. So as we go through them, and we'll try to quickly go through each of them, I want you to comment on them. You know, nutrition, and when they look at nutrition, they're not looking at nutrition as the majority of people in this country look at it. They look at a balanced diet of whole foods, of fruits, of vegetables, of seeds, grains, and nuts that are loaded with the essential nutrients, the vitamins, the minerals, the cofactors, and other things that we need to be healthy. And what does these foods do for us specifically? You're an endocrinologist. You understand the biochemistry. What, you know, are these foods actually doing, and why do they really make a difference?
An excellent question, Dr. Watkins. And I've done a little study that is, I have investigated what is written about these blue zones, these five different areas on the globe where it has been shown people live longer and live a more robust and active life than elsewhere on the planet in general. And it turns out that these areas that have been identified, as you've already alluded to, seem to practice a unique process of acquisition and utilization of nutrition, participation in exercise, and living in an environment that is low in toxins, and that which gives them plenty of fresh, clean water. And as I've analyzed this and looked at it more closely, I've determined that these areas are unique because of their isolation, which then has protected them from the influences of the general scheme of population and people around them. So much so that although these people live in particular areas, they aren't different from the people around them because of their genetics per se. As they've analyzed this data, crunched it through big computers, they can say, well, maybe 20% of this advantage that these people have is based on their genetics, but 80% of the advantage that they have in terms of lifestyle, health, being active, being vigorous, being vibrant, 80% of it is based on their lifestyle. And a significant portion of that lifestyle is their diet. Even if you look at one particular group, now you've mentioned the group in Loma Linda, California. We know that Loma Linda, California sprang up over the past 100 years and grew in population, being populated largely by a group of people who are Seventh-day Adventists. And that's because they started back over 100 years ago, a huge medical institution today. Back then, it was just a small sanitarium, but has grown to a center of excellence in Loma Linda, California. And these Adventist people have populated that area. But these people practice a habit that's quite different from the people in Riverside, which is just 5 miles to the west, or San Bernardino, which is 5 miles to the north, or Redlands, which is 5 miles to the east.
Oh, Lord.
Now, I won't say anything about what's south, because that's up in the mountains, and not many people that live up there. But they practice differently. And then I said, well, maybe these people, we know they have a different diet, and I know we'll come back to that. But then I looked at Japan, and we talked about Japan, and you pointed out Okinawa. Why is Okinawa different? Well, it turns out if you analyze Okinawa, it's an isolated Japanese island, which is far south of the rest of Japan. So when this blue zone that centers on Okinawa is talked about, they don't include the rest of Japan. The rest of Japan doesn't have this advantage.
That's right.
That Okinawa does. And Okinawa has this advantage because these people live differently even than the rest of the people in Japan who eat an Asian diet. But the people in Okinawa eat a diet that is more concentrated in eating fresh vegetables, fresh fruits, grains, and who limit significantly fats and oils and flesh foods. They do get some flesh food, but it's largely from white fish that they get into their diets. But they're not even getting, like the rest of Asia may be able to get access to beef and to pork and other animal-based proteins of that variety. Okinawa's an island. They don't have room to grow cattle ranches and farms. The people may eat some pork, but pork is not a large portion of their diet. And even the protein from fish is not a large portion of their diet. It comes from vegetables and fruit. And then Okinawa is farther south, isolated from the cities of the rest of Japan, so they have fresh air. It gets plenty of sunlight, and they have excellent clean water.
Wow.
So that's what makes the difference, it appears. If you look at Loma Linda, if you look at Okinawa, if you look at these areas of Greece and other areas of the world where the blue zone has been identified. For example, in Costa Rica and Sardinia, Italy, these are isolated areas where people have had to practice a different type of lifestyle, and the lifestyle they have practiced is largely plant-based, open air, sunlight receiving, fresh water environments.
You know, it's interesting because even if you go to many parts of rural Africa and you look at people, like I've looked at a number of studies of people in, say, Kenya, men living in Kenya in their 90s and 100s with blood pressures like they were when they were in their teens, you know. They've done studies in Uganda where they have looked at the hospitals there, no heart disease, no cancer, you know. I mean, it's just amazing. But they follow a traditional lifestyle. A lot of it is diet, but it really is more thinking, the way the people think, because they can choose to eat different, as many of their fellow countrymen do, but they do not. They choose to maintain a simple, basic diet of fruits, grains, seeds, nuts, a little meat. I remember when I was a freshman in medical school, I roomed with someone from Ghana, and so we would often eat with another friend of his from Ghana. And one day I said, George, why is it that every meal you eat two different meats? He said, because when I grew up, I didn't have a lot of meat. I said, so you're going to kill yourself now because you didn't have meat growing up. And we laughed about it. But that's just wasn't, you know, if they ate meat, it was more of for a condiment, a seasoning, rather than the larger portion of the meal. But then many, when they left, they wanted to be like Americans. And when you eat like Americans, you live like Americans, you're going to do what?
You die like Americans.
So now these foods, they reduce inflammation. They are antioxidant. Now, what does that mean? Why is that important? We throw these words around, but they are very, very significant.
Well, Dr. Watkins, you know, as time goes on, I become more and more astounded by what years ago we just thought of as simple nutritional guidance. Nowadays, on scientific analysis, and again, using these big supercomputers to look at various populations, groups of people, to analyze to the nth degree, to the smallest function, what it is that makes them different from other individuals. It all cycles back to a recognition that a lot of the ailments that people suffer from have a common trunk into the inflammatory or inflammation pathway of what's going on within the body. Now, people have years ago talked about the arthers, all right? Arthritis, arthralgia, So we call those the arthrs, and that means they've thought about their knees that hurt, or their ankles that hurt, or their fingers that hurt, or their elbows that hurt, and they've called it arthritis, and the doctors have told them, well, that's because you have inflammation in those joints. But it's only recently that we have recognized that that inflammation that is occurring in the joints isn't somehow just isolated to the joint. That cause of inflammation that's occurring in the joints is also happening elsewhere in the body. It's happening in the muscles that leads to morning stiffness, and muscle stiffness, even after people have sat in one position for a long period of time and try to get up. They find out that their muscles just won't relax and won't easily allow them to move around. That's inflammation that's causing that. When people climb out of bed and have to sit on the edge of the bed for a while and start moving their limbs around before they try to get up, otherwise they know they will possibly stumble, they do that because overnight that inflammation, that means irritation and heat development in those tissues has occurred. And so they have to release it. But then we became aware through this research that those same people who had these higher levels of inflammation in their body, and we discovered ways that we could measure with a blood test how much inflammation a person had in general. It turns out those people were the people who were developing higher rates of cancers. That indeed the development of cancer somehow was linked to whatever it was that was related to the inflammation that they were developing. And therefore, we scratched our heads and began to think about other issues that were going on. And only within the past 15 years, 20 years, and I being a diabetes specialist who practiced endocrinology and diabetology for years, did not realize 25 or 30 years ago how dramatic an influence inflammation had on whether I saw a person who did or did not develop diabetes based on their inflammatory or inflammation content in their body. We now know that a significant development of that inflammation, the production of those chemicals in the body that lead to inflammation, come from the metabolism of what people have eaten. It comes from their nutrition and what kind of things they've ingested. And if they ingest a diet that is high in highly refined, simple carbohydrates like starches, highly refined flour, polished rice, white potatoes, granulated sugar, or a diet that is high in oils and fats, or the combination of both, which is like putting a bomb together, those combinations and excess amounts of those individual ingredients give the liver an opportunity to produce those substances that then go out to the rest of the body and cause the inflammation that we suffer from. So people are running around now talking about, oh, I think, you know, I saw something in the magazine that said turmeric was good for inflammation and would help my arthritis be better. And you know, I took some, I started using it, and I agree, I don't have as much pain or as much soreness. Well, they're circling all the way back around to take a natural food to cut down on the inflammation. And what it's doing is defeating the inflammation that has come about because of the excess amounts of refined carbohydrates and fats that the people have eaten in their diets.
And what about heart disease?
Oh, man.
And strokes.
Well, that's the issue there. You see, as this blood comes out of the heart, as the heart is beating, it's beating the blood that has been supplemented with and given these inflammatory compounds that the liver has made from what we have eaten. And those inflammatory compounds go all throughout the body and cause that inflammation. When it occurs in the blood vessels, it causes irritation in the blood vessels. And actually, with the association of some of the substances that caused the inflammation in the first place, will cause small microscopic ruptures in the internal lining of the blood vessels, so that these inflammatory chemicals and these fats and lipids will get laid down in those blood vessels. And then when you get inflammation in the blood vessel underneath that internal covering, well, you get swelling, just like you get swelling elsewhere in your body when you have inflammation. But the blood vessel only has so much room inside of it. So that swelling causes that internal layer to begin to puff up and build up. But the blood has to get through. So the heart pumps harder, raises the blood pressure to get that pressure through. And that sheer force of that blood going through that blood vessel at high speed under high pressure is like what happens when you buy one of these hoses. You know, they have them, they advertise them on TV, and they talk about how this hose can, with this special nozzle, can develop this pressure, and you can clean off your sidewalk and your pavement and the side of your house. Well, that's what's happening inside of your blood vessel. That blood is going through at high pressure, at high speed, because the vessel is narrow. And it damages more on the internal until our friendly fix it all, the clot forms. You know, clots form when you've cut yourself and you start to bleed, and the body will put platelets and other chemicals in that area to stop the bleeding. Well, inside of those blood vessels, you get damage to the blood vessels. A clot can form, and it can form very rapidly. So people who have heart attacks and strokes often are having those things occur because they have had already an abnormality and swelling inside of the blood vessel because of the what they've eaten and the inflammation and perhaps the buildup of plaque, cholesterol, and other things inside that blood vessel. And then that sheer force of that blood going through there after a while may rupture a portion of that blood vessel. And so the platelets and these chemicals go in to fix it. But when they fix it good. They close that vessel off completely. And that's the heart attack.
That's, you know, and that's part of the immune system, the immune system that is there to protect us, but when used in excess, it works against us. Now, you taught me something a year or two ago that was very, very significant, and I'm not sure, but I believe there's some interplay here, and that's this thing called insulin resistance, the number one cause of diabetes, but you indicated that it's not just associated with diabetes, it's associated with heart disease and hyperlipidemias and strokes. And is there any relationship to this diet thing and insulin resistance?
Oh, yes, quite definitely. Quite definitely.
And let me just say this. And the reason it was so significant is you said that we don't have a clinical study to measure insulin resistance. Like we can measure the hemoglobin A1C, or we can measure the glomerular filtration rate. We can't measure, as a physician, I can't go and order a measurement for insulin resistance. So take it from there.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In order to determine how we discovered the whole issue of insulin resistance was after we had built these huge medical centers and research laboratories and institutions where we could hook people up to multi-million dollar machines to measure all different components of what was going on there in their bodies, that we determined that the people were not responding well to the insulin that they were making already, or that we would give them as part of a test. You can't measure that in the doctor's office. You can't go down to the LabCorp or the other clinical laboratories and just get a blood test for this. But what is taking place is that this insulin resistance, which is part of this metabolic syndrome, is occurring early on in the process of disease development. Part of it's being caused by that inflammatory state. Part of it may be caused by the person's genetic background in general, but could have been overcome by appropriate diet and lifestyle. But still, other parts of that insulin resistance occurs because of the types of foods that the person eats. Mm. And the types of foods that give rise to insulin resistance are those foods that, when they go through the mouth, down the esophagus, into the stomach, you get mixed up with the acid to break down the food and then into the small intestine, that the particles, the bits and pieces of nutrients that then go through the veins that lead from the intestines to the liver, those constituents get used by the liver to produce materials, inflammation materials, clotting materials, materials that block the ability of the liver to respond to the natural insulin that a person is producing, and even materials that go out to the rest of the body and block the rest of the body from responding to the insulin. That has come about because of what the person has eaten. And that insulin resistance has come about because of that. Now, early on, that insulin resistance is there and the people aren't responding well to the insulin that they have made. But their blood sugars, when the doctor measures the blood sugar in the office, may look pretty normal. But behind the scenes, all of this inflammation and all of this increased stickiness and clottiness of the blood and all of these increases in cholesterol, especially LDL cholesterol, the bad cholesterol, circulating triglycerides, all of this is going on beneath the surface. If we had a way that we could measure such things as insulin resistance, we would see one of the early signs that a person is at risk for diabetes, even before their blood sugar goes up. And that would be so valuable if indeed we had it. But we don't have that, and I don't anticipate we'll have it soon, but we know how to prevent the body from becoming insulin resistant by and large through lifestyle and diet. But if we could do that, then we could keep people from going on to develop diabetes later on, because the elevation in blood sugar is one of the last things that happens abnormally, as a person has previously been going through all of these months and years of insulin resistance and what we sometimes call inflammatory state, and perhaps which even constitutes what some people now call pre-diabetes. They don't have diabetes, but something is happening to the blood sugar. If you go back in time and look at those people's charts, you'll find out that 10 years, 15 years ago, they were developing high blood pressure. 10 years, 15 years ago, their cholesterol was going up. 10 years, 15 years ago, their triglycerides were abnormal. Their LDL cholesterol was too high. But their blood sugars back then were normal. And so people focus on, oh, the doctor told me my blood pressure is bad, but, you know, I'm going to try. But they don't stay away from the salt and the sodium and other things that we know will help. But by and large, now we know it's what they're putting into their mouths through simple nutritional processes that gave rise to the basis that later on became elevated blood sugar. The elevated blood sugar is just a flag that says, well, I tell you like this. You know, we used to say when I was a child, when people were in the water and they were getting into trouble, they would go down once, come back up, and they would go down twice.
Yes.
And come back up. And when they went down the third time,
that was it.
That's it. Well, good people, when your blood sugar starts to come up, that's the third time.
That's the third time.
That's the third time. When your blood sugar starts to go up, all of those other things were happening years ago and setting you up for what then would become the heart attack and the stroke, but the claudication, which is when you get cramps in the muscles of your legs when you're walking too fast or climbing stairs, the potential for amputations. And only after the blood sugar goes up, then do you begin to develop the eye disease and the kidney disease. Although if you had high blood pressure 15 years ago, that could have done your kidneys in way back then.
Yes.
That was an early part of the metabolic syndrome.
Mercy. Now we talked about the 8 laws of health. We spent most of the time talking about nutrition, and rightly so, since it's the number one cause of death in this country. But also, this thing of exercise. Exercise. Now, why is exercise so important from a health perspective? Not from a recreational perspective, from a health perspective. Why is exercise, in particular, I want to talk about walking. Why is that so important?
Because you are exercising those organs in your body, your muscles, that are the predominant target of how your body handles the nutrients that come into your body after your liver has done what it's going to do with them. The glucose or sugar that you take in is either used immediately by your muscles or it is stored away in your muscles. The proteins that you take in are broken down to amino acids, go out from the intestines through the liver and out to the rest of the body to help build up the strength in muscles. And even the fats and fatty acids are metabolized either as energy sources or stored away in the muscles. Now, the muscles can even store the sugar that doesn't get used right away in the form of what's called glycogen. The muscles constitute a huge repository of the energy that we have eaten. And as you exercise your muscles, you build up that machinery in your muscles to use what you have eaten, to be prepared to use what you have eaten. And later on, if you need that, those sources of energy, to release the energy that you have eaten. But along with the muscles being able to store it, you have to give them circulation. You have to be able to get those things to the muscles. And the only way you get those things to the muscles is to exercise those muscles. And you have to breathe in fresh air in order for the blood to take the oxygen to the muscles so that the chemical transformations and the laying down of these ingredients can take place in the muscles. Oh, and by the way, the sunlight is important because the sunlight actually turns around some of the chemicals and vitamins that you have in your body so that the muscles can use these nutrients or store these nutrients more efficiently. So exercise is extremely important as we go through our daily lives. The body has very sensitive mechanisms that will tell it through the muscles and through the liver and the digestive system what to do with what at various points in time. But if we sit around on the couch and the sofa watching TV and not getting up and exercising, we shut down a whole part of that factory system. Some of us have parents, or maybe we ourselves have worked in industry, and we've worked maybe in big industry where you see acres and acres of buildings that do different things in that particular corporation. One building does this, and another building does the other, and another building does a third thing, and more and more and more. That's what's going on in our bodies. But if you don't use one of those buildings for a while, and then push all of your product over to that building, there's nothing that can be done over there of any efficiency because it hasn't been used.
So now we won't go into to detail, but exercise also increases bone strength. It helps to with the circulation of the blood and so forth. But I want to talk a little bit about water. You know, I admit that I don't really like water, but I know that I have to drink it, so I force myself to drink it. Why is water so vital as part of these eight laws of health?
Yes, water is important because it is how our blood is able to move freely and the heart can pump it effortlessly into these tissues. And water not only takes the blood and nutrients into the tissues, those tissues have to get rid of the byproducts. They have to get rid of the exhaust that comes from all of this metabolism. The water brings those chemicals and waste products back out of those tissues, takes it to the kidneys, and then the kidneys get rid of it in our urine. So you have to keep a constant turnover, a constant flow of water, fresh water, not tainted water, not chemically infused water.
So you're getting out, you're getting this water, you're getting your exercise, you're eating right, but if you don't get rest, what happens?
You wear the bearings out in that machinery. You have to rest so that the observation and repair of the components of the machine get a chance to be rejuvenated.
All right.
You can't just use it constantly without rest. And that rest is extremely important. Stress-free rest. So if a person is not sleeping well through the night, we need to know about it and need to do things to help them sleep well, because the repair of that machinery, including the brain, as well as the muscles and organs, takes place when we rest.
And lastly, trust in divine power. Why is that important?
Oh my goodness. Because just like with all of our overt sins of deeds, of things that we're doing that we know mentally we should not do, the divine power can also lift us up, rejuvenate us, and replenish us through the errors and mistakes that we make without knowing that that's what we're doing. So we pray that the good Lord will bless us, forgive us for what we've done intentionally, but also cover our mistakes for what we haven't done, and pray for the indwelling of His Holy Spirit that will protect us and refine what we have.
And give us power to change. Brother Frank, any closing comments? Man, we've been rolling. Anybody chance to get on the phone, but any closing comments, my brother?
Yeah, we gotta have you back again to revisit this topic. I mean, you did a great job of overviewing it, but we gotta have you back and tell people how this applies to them, for sure, especially in these political and economic times. We thank you for being a guest, and it's not even a guest. You're a star on the show, for sure. If you want to talk to Dr. Watkins and make an appointment, dial 202-388-0992, Tuesday through Thursdays, 10 to 5, or go to www.twiliving.com. That's the Watkins Institute.com, living.com. We want to thank Doc for having Dr. Cheatham on, for sure. Dr. Cheatham is retired, ostensibly. But he's helping out everywhere else, to tell you. So you can't reach him. You have to reach him indirectly, so I won't give his contact information. Thank you, Magic Mike, Cody, Kalia, and all of our engineering staff. Thank you to WPFW staff, programmers, volunteers, and local loyal listeners. Thank you for supporting the 48th anniversary affair Friday night. Thank you for your musical contributions, Maka B and Ola Dari. Stay tuned to WPFW. Next up is jazz. It's Brother Kaba with African Deeper Thought Edition. And listen in next Monday at 2 p.m. for another life-saving broadcast of To Your Health.
Salamata. I tell on a vegan, we're vegan. I and I eat from the earth, I need the animals to give birth. No deaders, no fur, no feathers. When I tell people I don't eat meat, fish or dairy, then look for me strangely. Then I realize I eat a very wide variety. Listen to Maccabee. Yo, how when me eat, them I wonder when me eat. When me tell them, say me not eat no fish, no meat now. How when me eat, them I wonder when me yum. When me tell them, say
that I'm... WPFW has been a site of resistance in defense of truth, justice, and culture for 48 years. Our spring membership drive begins with a special celebration of James Brown's birthday, May 3rd, and closes with a centennial birthday celebration of Malcolm X on May 19th. Two pillars of music and message. Your financial sustenance is needed more than ever to continue this type of programming. As a new listener or current member, this is your opportunity to contribute to the growth of an institution that stands resolute against both gross injustice and repression and the mass erasure of history and culture by amplifying the voices of scholars, artists, and activists whose work centers the humanity of all people. That's 48 years of being a site of resistance in defense of truth, justice, and culture, May 3rd through the 19th. WPFW works daily to build the world we want to inhabit by building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Good afternoon. For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Darnia Samuels. Here are some headlines for this hour. Today marks 1 week since Pope Francis passed away. His funeral was held over the weekend, and more than 250,000 people, young and old, attended to pay their respects to the 266th Pope of the Roman Catholic Church. He was remembered as, quote, a Pope among the people with an open heart towards everyone, and as someone with a marked attention to those in difficulty, giving himself without measure, especially to the marginalized. Due to the Pope's death, cardinals will be starting conclave, or their assembly, to elect a new Pope. There are currently 135 cardinals eligible to participate in the upcoming election. The cardinals have chosen May 7th as the day to begin. Russia's President Vladimir Putin declared a 72-hour ceasefire next week in Ukraine to mark the 80th anniversary of Victory Day, which is Russia's biggest secular holiday. Victory Day commemorates Moscow's defeat of Nazi Germany in 1945 during World War II. The truce that Vladimir Putin has called for was ordered on, quote, humanitarian grounds, and will run from the start of May 8th and last through the end of May 10th. However, Ukraine has dismissed Putin's decision as superficial or something just to attract attention. Ukraine's foreign minister said, and I quote, if Russia truly wants peace, it must cease fire immediately. Why wait for May 8th? End quote. He added that Ukraine is ready to support a lasting, durable, and full ceasefire. And quote, this is what we are constantly proposing for at least 30 days. Ukraine previously agreed to President Trump's proposal of a full 30-day ceasefire. In New York City, the police department is investigating a series of incidents stemming from clashing protests last week that began when a group of anti-Israel protesters surrounded a Jewish place of worship in Brooklyn. The demonstrations coincided with a recent visit to the city by Israel's national security minister. According to Mayor Eric Adams, quote, initial reports indicate that one female protester was isolated from her group, harassed by counter-protesters, and suffered injuries. In another incident, a second woman was surrounded and subjected to vile threatening by counter-protesters, end quote. Mayor Adams said the police are working to identify those related to this assault and that one person has been arrested. He also urged the two targeted women to file complaints against their assailants, having said that, quote, hate has no place in New York City. To the D.C. area, the Washington Commanders will soon be coming back to the nation's capital. Today, Mayor Bowser announced that the team and the district reached a nearly $4 billion deal to build a 65,000-seat stadium at the RFK Stadium site, with plans to open the venue in 2030. The Commanders plan to contribute $2.7 billion, with the city vowing to invest roughly $1.1 billion over the next 8 years for the new stadium and nearby structures. In a news conference this morning with Commanders owner Josh Harris and NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell, Mayor Bowser explained that the deal will bring about not only a sports complex, but will provide housing, jobs, and a youth recreation center for D.C. residents. The deal between the district and the Commanders still needs to be approved by the D.C. Council. In today's weather, it's currently about 71 degrees in D.C. That's all for your headline news this hour. For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Darnia Samuels. Please be safe and thank you for listening.